I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Waypoint UK podcast, episode 11 for May 18th, 2017. Hopefully. We're recording this a little bit early, so hopefully the world hasn't ended between now and then. My name is Mike Divis, Senior Editor at Waypoint. I'm joined today for a bit of a special podcast, I guess, a bit of a featured game podcast, because why not? We like to mix it up a bit, by Steve Burns.
Hello, Mike. How's it going?
It's going all right. You've been here before.
I have.
On a previous...
Talking a load of nonsense to you about video
games. Bullshit. Yeah. I mean, this is what we like to do, isn't it?
I mean, that is the industry, isn't it?
That's the whole gaming industry, yeah. And speaking of bullshit in the games industry, I don't know. Sorry, Ed. I don't know why I said that.
It's quite all right.
It's completely unreasonable. Ed Smith is with us as well, albeit on Skype this time. You're obviously here again... You were here before as well, a few months back, weren't you? We were talking about Wildlands and how much you really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm still playing Wildlands. Finished it, started it again, finished it, started it a third time. It's excellent.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, I'm hoping we're going to really dedicate some time to talking about Wildlands again this episode.
I think we should. I mean, of all the Ubisoft games with lots of waypoints, it's probably the best Ubisoft game with all of the waypoints, but none of the towers. But anyway... what we want to talk about today isn't Ghost Recon or anything. It's Max Payne 3, because on the day you're hearing this, or the day it's become available anyway, it's actually the fifth anniversary of Max Payne 3 coming out in the UK and other parts of the world. On the Xbox and PlayStation 3, at least anyway, there was a small delay for PC, which I think Rockstar did as well with GTA, didn't they? PC version came out later as well on that, and probably, well, of course, Red Dead Redemption's PC edition is never gonna happen. So yeah, a spoiler warning right now, this is a very, very Max Payne 3, exclusively Max Payne 3 focused podcast, so we're gonna be delving into all kinds of spoilers about Rockstar's game, the third game in the Max Payne series, obviously, why it's good, why we like it, why we don't, what works, what doesn't, you know, why you should play it today or not. It's just a nice novel twist on our usual kind of magazine-y formula to do a more of a deep dive on one game. So, Max Payne 3, collectively developed and published by Rockstar. And I've written down in my notes, I'm not really sure which studio did what, but there's a lot of them involved. Leeds, New York, Vancouver, definitely, possibly others. You guys, when did this game kind of fall into your laps and you first took it for a spin?
I got this game the day it came out. I remember it well. Well, not well, but I remember it.
I hope you remember it well enough, Ed. We're going to do a whole podcast.
I got this game the first day it came out and completed it over the first weekend that it was out. So, yeah, I was waiting for this game and was there from the beginning.
Which is always nice to see. I mean, I got it at release as well. And I can't remember if I played it straight through. But I remember it not taking very long. Although when I replayed it over the last few days or over the last couple of weeks, really, on and off, it seemed to take a lot longer than I remember. Steve, what about yourself?
So I got it... Well, I didn't... In fact, I reviewed it. So I played... So I went to Rockstar's London office to have a little look at it. But not play it, you know, just have a little look at it.
You weren't allowed to play it?
You know what, I can't remember. It's, you know, it's a long... I'm an old man now. So I was young when it came out. And so we went there and then I played the multiplayer there and then I reviewed it. So had it a bit earlier, but not massively earlier. But yeah, I remember thinking, wow, this is both the Max Payne game that I thought it would be and definitely not the Max Payne game that I thought it would be. I had to hold those two things in my head simultaneously, which as a games journalist is a very difficult proposition.
We don't do balancing acts very
absolutely
or juggling.
Not. Dissonance is bad. Everything is
I've
good.
I've heard that. I've heard that dissonance is an issue in video gaming in so many ways. But what I was looking into the game a little bit for my notes. Obviously, it came out in 2012. It was intended for March that year, but eventually came out in May. Take Two, who obviously own Rockstar, well, I say obviously, if you know about games, you probably know that. They kept moving the game back and back and back originally because Take Two picked up the license some years prior to the game coming out. Yep. It was originally scheduled for 2009.
Yes, it was, yeah.
Which seems, that seems like quite a delay of 3 years.
It was.
I mean, do either of you know why Take Two, why Rockstar were pushing that back? I mean, I'm trying to think what they were making at the time. Obviously, Red Dead was happening.
Well, I think from various rumours, speculation, and some things that some people from Rockstar have said, that in that period, there was issues, I think, for Rockstar. If you think that L.A. Noire, which they didn't make, but they kind of took over, had problems. Red Dead Redemption, quite famously and seriously, had a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. And I think Max Payne 3 really did have quite a lot, which I don't think were actually fully sorted for release. I think the game is like one of the best 7 out of 10s that I've ever played. And it's one of those games that just sits in my brain. And every now and then I just think of, Max Payne 3, that had some really cool stuff in it. Like other games just go in and then just immediately get flushed.
Yeah.
Like there are so many good games or games that you've given good scores to that you kind of just, they are good and they're competent and maybe you like them. Max Payne 3, I think because it didn't deliver on all the things that it was going to, apparently. Just sits there as this kind of nearly classic or this nearly game in a lot of ways. But going back to it, you're like, man, there's some really good stuff in it. Some really, really good stuff. And that's the stuff you remember.
Yeah, I mean, replaying it, I've discovered a lot of that good stuff and some not so good stuff as well. But I mean, Ed, you wrote a piece for, I want to say pre-Waypoint when it was Vice Gaming. Your kind of take on Max Payne 3, certainly for that piece, and was that it was your favorite game to bear the Rockstar badge. I mean, why does this game for you stand out? I mean, I guess I kind of side with Steve in so much as, it's one of my favorite 7 out of 10s. You can see where all the bits that could be improved are, but at the same time, there's something about it that sticks around. And even before this podcast was planned in my head, I kept on thinking, I really want to, at some point I want to go back to that game, which obviously, shows there's something about it. So what is your, I guess, personal something about this game?
I should say, first of all, that for me to say it's the best game Rockstar has produced, in my mind, that's not enormous praise, because I'm not bowled over by a lot of their work. I think
you're quite into L.A. Noire as well, aren't you?
They published that. Yeah, and Red Dead Redemption's okay, but it's so derivative of so many westerns, and Grand Theft Auto V is catastrophic, and GTA 4 is dead good. But again, I think Max Payne 3 is better. I like it a lot, this game, and if we were doing a sort of desert island games, I would probably put it in there. But I certainly don't think it's above a good kicking. I think part of the reason that I enjoy it is because it's an enjoyable game to criticize. It's a good one to bat back and forth. It's an interesting game to talk about. But yeah, it's not good without, mitigation or caveat. There's a lot of things about Max Payne 3 which you can deride quite rightly. And I'd like to talk about those, I think. I think that what's happened with Max Payne 3 over the last 5 years is that it's starting to undergo a kind of revisionist reappraisal. And what can happen in those periods is that people get a little bit too sort of febrile about it, and everyone wants to talk about how much better this game is than people remember. But Max Payne 3 has got shortcomings, and I think they're as enjoyable to talk about as its qualities.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, when it came out, you look at the review scores it got, and they were actually higher than I maybe anticipated looking back. There's a lot of high 80s across the three versions. I mean, do you think that the level of praise it attracted from a lot of people, is that because of the precedent set by the previous games and because of kind of Rockstar's I guess, public perception, the kind of the games they put out before. Mm. Obviously, this is coming out after GTA 4, which was very, very well loved, sold a lot of copies. Do you think the kind of heritage of the series, and, you know, got to remember that Remedy, while they didn't make this game, they advised on it. Remedy, of course, who made the first two Max Payne games. So there's still plenty of old Max Payne in this game. And Rockstar, I'm struggling to think of the last time Rockstar were, you know, put out a game that was kind of critically mauled. You guys can probably help me if there's been one. I can't think of one really.
Was it? I don't think it was mauled. I think I gave it something like 78, which, you know,
that's very
which
high.
Is a mauling, apparently.
Yes, of course.
But no, it for me, I think Ed's right in some instances there, that I think the reason why it sticks in people's brains is because of its shortcomings as much as how well it executes certain things. I can't think of a Rockstar game really, as in one that they made and didn't just publish. I mean, didn't they did State of Emergency, didn't they? But I think it is the one which attracted, I would say, the most criticism. And I think the reasons for those are many and varied. But I remember thinking at the time, it was unusual for a Rockstar game, and you're speaking amongst the games press, for it to have that much pushback. Usually when you're playing a GTA or a Red Dead, etc., it's just, you know, a bit of a love-in, which, you know, I really like those games, it's fine. But it was unusual at the time in that world to be like, have you played Max Payne 3? It's like, yeah, it's okay, but there's some really bad bits. And you're like, whoa, guys, what's happening?
I'm glad it reviewed well. I think it deserved to be reviewed well, but I don't think it was praised for the right reasons. And I don't think it was criticized for the right reasons. Like, the game deserves a few slaps, and it also deserves, you know, like to be talked up. But I think, and I didn't write about it because I hadn't really started working this job in 2012. It's a bit before my time. But I can remember being enthused by things that in hindsight, I think are the less interesting parts of the game, and also being critical of things that in hindsight are not the game's sort of steepest problems. So I'm glad that it's getting talked about again, this game, because it's fascinating.
Did you both come into it, I mean, as I did with previous Max Payne experiences? I really enjoyed the second Max Payne game. I didn't get the time I should have taken with the first. It was a little bit, I didn't get a PS2 until after Max Payne and Max Payne 2 were already out, and then I only actually played Max Payne 2 because the 360 had it backwards compatible. You know, you could play a few original Xbox games on it, so I did it that way. But I really enjoyed that. Obviously, that's Mona Sachs et al, and there are callbacks to that in Max Payne 3. But I mean, did you both have prior experiences, and did that help shape your appreciation of this game?
I played the first two games substantially. I think that first Max Payne game is probably instrumental in getting me interested in games in the first place, in a kind of serious sense. Yeah, I played the first two a lot by the time the third one came out.
Yeah, same. I remember reading about the original Max Payne in Arcade magazine, and this was got to be 1999, 2000 sort of era, and it had been in the works for years, and, you know, it had all this kind of hype behind it, but it had a stupid name. Well, that we'll get onto that, but there was a little caption, you know, in the preview roundups you used to get in magazines. You know, might as well be talking about 8-track now, but you know, so you'd put in all the games that were meant to be coming out, and any games that had slipped, and I did this when I became a writer on a magazine, you know, you just include an image, and it's probably the same image 6 months in a row, so no new shots. And I remember them saying something along the lines of, yeah, it's probably never going to come out. And yeah, it did. And I remember I found it to be amazing. Not just because I thought that the graphics were good. It, you know, it's got the square, it's like the GoldenEye square faces, but for a new generation.
I mean, it's Sam Lake's face as well, which is great, isn't it?
But it looked, but it wasn't just that it was good. It had, even though you can poke holes in it, it had something really cohesive about the entire thing. It wasn't just another power fantasy, like, he is a loser. And you're met, you know, it's a comic book. You read the comic book and you're kind of like, man. And it pokes fun at itself. There's a reflexivity there to the game, which I found interesting. I mean, it's a bit kind of like film school, you know, but at the same time, the game's called Max Payne. And this is, on a side note, when people were like, it's very verbose Alan Wake, isn't it? He's like, his name's Mr. Awake and he's got insomnia. Like, come on now, please play the game. I know video game people are quite literal, but, you know, come on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously this transferred from Remedy to Rockstar. Do you think that is to Max Payne 3's benefit? Do you mean, because I don't know, well, obviously it's because Take-Two bought the IP, but they could have, you know, employed Remedy to make another one. I guess Remedy at the time had just done, well, they were making Alan Wake.
Yeah,
during
and
the
that another game which was in a bit of problems.
That other game.
Fully open world, wasn't it? Like Deadly Premonition became to be.
Oh, right.
I think it was a good job that it switched from Remedy to somebody else. I thought, having played Alan Wake and then Quantum Break, I've lost interest, I think, in Remedy. And also, if you play that second Max Payne game, it's good, but it's very similar in pretty much every sense to the first.
Yeah, it's like a better looking version of it in many ways.
Yeah.
It's the same story retold effectively.
Yeah, and exactly. It's like thematically really consistent, and I still like it. And it's got a lot of really interesting little flourishes. That funhouse level in the second Max Payne game is terrific. But leaving it for 9 years and then transferring it to a different game maker gives there's a little freedom there to just sort of wrench it out and do something utterly different with it. And it's not often that you get that, I don't think, in games generally, or even in like movies or whatever, where they just like completely reinvent the, you know, the aesthetic and the setting and all that stuff. And yeah, I'm really glad with what they did with it, putting it in Brazil, and he's older and fatter, and
I mean, he's never been more of a waste, has he? He's useless. Well, he's not useless, obviously. You know, he manages to make it out of there, but
they dispose of all the supporting cast from the previous two games. They take it out of the nighttime. It's a very kind of daylight set game, and the music is very different. Everything about it is different. It doesn't scream Max Payne immediately, and I think that's precisely what it needed.
Yeah, well, let's talk about a few positives then, because I know we've got things that we're hung up on. I mean, the whole point of this podcast really is that we get to address, like we've already said here, like it's an interesting game. It deserves another look, and I think it's something that, you know, it's not backwards compatible. It's not on new consoles, but if you've got one of those older consoles, then it's so cheap. Like, it's £2.50.
And the PC version still looks amazing.
The PC version looks amazing. Incredible. I mean, I played through it on the 360. It's still, you know, it's a bit stiff. Some of the backgrounds are fuzzy, but generally it holds up pretty well.
I think it looked great at the time. Yeah. And like I said, the PC version, I played it this morning before I attempted to get somewhere in London, which was a mistake, but that's an aside. And it's absolutely fantastic in its look. But to pick up, it's probably about, you know, talking about its aesthetic. And, you know, and by that, don't just mean like how it looks, but everything else associated with that term. Yeah, it is incredibly consistent. And one of the things that I think it got sledged for a little bit, but actually now, with the benefit of hindsight, playing it again, is that it's actually an incredibly funny game.
It plays up to the fact that it is a game.
Yeah, I thought that the reason why I wasn't too up on it at the time, one of the reasons is I felt that Rockstar kind of lost that Max Payne edge. Like, it's called Max Payne, and, you know, I didn't find it, it felt a bit too self-involved for me, and it felt like they'd seen Man on Fire, which obviously they had.
It is Man on Fire.
It is. I mean, you know, it's a Tony Scott production.
Do you really think so?
In a superficial things that happen sense, I think the influence is definitely there, isn't it?
In terms of how it lifts some of the looks and some of the screen furniture and some of that. However,
Mexico City and versus Sao Paulo kind of thing.
Yeah. However, in terms of it actually being like Man on Fire, the Scott version is, you know, he's redeemed, you know, Chris is redeemed by his relationship with the person in his charge. However, in Max Payne, and this is the thing that I really like about it, Max Payne 3, is that he is fucking useless. He is useless. And any time that he tries to do anything positive, it turns into a world of shit. But he knows that. So there's this thing going on in his brain where he's like, he wants in some way to not be the man he is. But he only accepts to go to Brazil because he's killed the local mob boss's son. He's not out for anything. And he's in Man on Fire. after he teaches, you know, Dakota Fanning to swim, then and she gets taken, then he has a reason to live. I don't think Max Payne has a reason to live. He just exists.
Yeah, I mean, toward the back third of the game is entirely him pretty much trying to kill himself, isn't it?
Yeah. And he talks about Fabiana after the head of the Brancos is killed in the office.
Yeah.
And he's like, and there's a lovely moment where he picks up her picture as he's trying to get a bottle of Jack Daniels out. And he's like, oh, well, if I could just save her, then drops the picture. And then gets exploded out of a window. And that is the Max Payne story in like three movements of the human body.
Well, if that was the comic, you know, the old comic strip way of doing it, that would be three frames, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
three of those little ding, 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 bong, out you go. I mean, Ed, do you want to pick up on any, I don't know, aesthetic or plotline influences from elsewhere then?
They've definitely stolen the Tony Scott, the way that he edited Man on Fire. And I think it's to Max Payne 3's detriment. Those cutscenes are a little bit hysterical.
They're a bit over the top, aren't they?
There are too many cuts within cuts. The words on the screen don't really give you much. The sort of washed out kind of reverb effect he puts on some of the Rockstar puts on some of the images. It's distracting more than anything, and like an affectation. Man on Fire is a really boring film, whereas Max Payne 3 is a really exciting game. So I'm glad that they left it. I'm glad that they left Man on Fire at a certain point, but you do have that kind of fish out of water, you know, American in the sort of, you know, what the film would describe and what the game would describe, the kind of savagery of South America. I can see, you know, it's certainly in line with Rockstar's kind of MO to start with a film and then build a game out of there. I think Steve is that's a really well observed look at that scene with the picture frame in the office. And Max is a fun character to be around despite his best efforts, because you are aware that he keeps messing this up, and in almost every level in Max Payne 3 begins with like a stated objective: protect the girls while they go nightclubbing, hand off the money at the stadium, rescue Fabiana from the dock, or even just in that fourth level, go and have a drink at a bar in New Jersey. And
without murdering everyone.
Yeah. Exactly. And every single time he says like something, or the game says, this is what's going to happen, the opposite happens and it gets much worse. And, you know, in a popular culture, I think that's often rife with films where and games where men say they're going to do something and then they do it, Max Payne 3 is a kind of a notable exception. But yeah, like you were talking about, I think Mike and Steve, I think you both mentioned this. It's also like a funny game, and it becomes a sort of like circus just to see like how self-pitying Max Payne can get. Because he's so... like there's such an hypocrisy in him, in as much as he's amazingly skilled, like huge, like 6'5", you know, 230-pound guy.
He seems to get bigger as the game goes through as well. I genuinely noticed this. At the end, when he's Bruce Willis, he's huge.
He's huge, and he's like capable and fierce and all of this stuff, but also such a kind of, you know, violin player. And
he plays the piano, doesn't he, at least?
Well, yeah.
little Easter eggy bits, yeah.
And I don't think I've ever quite managed to articulate, even to myself, precisely what it is about that helps him be compelling. But just watching Max Payne 3 fuck things up and then complain is entertaining.
I think you're absolutely right. There's something there. And I think after decades of power fantasy and wearing a bandana and I've got a chainsaw on the gun. And hey, listen, I like that first game. But, you know, there is no reflection in a lot of video game action heroes, because the only thing that they want to elicit really is, you know, I'm the man. Whereas there is that thing with Max Payne where some of his responses are not proportional. When he shoots the mob boss's son in the chest because he hits the woman with the gun, that is not a proportional response. That is the man on the edge from the, you know, from the tagline. And then he immediately says, why did I do that? And so there are, and I think as well, right at the end of each stage, or sorry, each scene, as you might call it, where you get the slow-mo, where you can just keep pumping bullets into people until you actually feel, you know, especially as I say, the PC version, that is grotesque. And then you're into a cutscene where he goes, fuck. And you're like, oh, and there is a reflection period in almost everything that you do in it. And the game, he keeps on scrabbling around in the dirt for this meaning in his life. And the only thing that he's really good at is killing people, and he hates it.
I think that this is it. I think you've broken its back, because what happens in a game like, say, Uncharted or Red Dead Redemption, where we're sort of informed tacitly that we're supposed to be interested in the protagonist and his psychology, and I emphasize his psychology, is you end up with these characters that they're not morally uncomplicated in the sense that they always get like some soliloquy at some point where they, you know, talk about, oh God, isn't it terrible what I do? Or am I really Nathan Drake? Or blah, blah, blah. And they always get like that moment, but it's kind of artificial and it's been placed there deliberately. And it feels kind of like grandiloquent and strained a little bit. Whereas what you've got with Max Payne 3 is you've got this guy who goes around, albeit in our control, goes around doing the things that you typically expect from a bloke in a game to do, kill people and et cetera, and cause explosions and run rampage. And then every single time he worries about it. He's like, what am I doing? And he sort of acknowledges the sort of absurdity of the situation that he's creating, not just the situation he's in, the situation he's creating. And it's that kind of, it's like the comedy of video games, almost like the comedy of action films, watching a guy shoot people and then he, like us, thinking, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's almost like the addiction element for Max Payne, especially in this one, is that you know, in terms of how people who have an addiction, that they can, maybe they'll go clean or they won't do the thing. And this can be an addiction to anything. It's not just the standard vices or things that, you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing or up to. And then once they do it, they want to do it. They feel that they have to do it. And then they get the bit of, they get the immediate kind of remorse, or some of them do. And Max Payne has a lot of remorse in him, which makes him more interesting, as you're saying there, than just the usual man rides into town, shoots up the saloon and goes, yeah, but look, I was forced into it because my wife was killed. It's like Max Payne makes it very clear that his family were killed a long time ago and he should actually make some positive steps as much as he can, but he just can't. And and it's secretly, I think deep down in it, he actually realizes he's really good at it.
I think I think that's to Max Payne's credit, that the writers don't make too big a deal of the family death. He mentions it like once in a flashback on a boat. Obviously one scene starts
where he's sitting in the front looking terrible.
You know, but like, it would have been very easy for the new writers here to go, right, okay, like you say, it's been that amount of time. People probably haven't played the first game. They're not really aware of what's kind of kickstarted Max's character as we see it here. But I think they underplay it. And I think that's to the story such as it is in this game's credit, which I don't think is a particularly strong story, but I think they could have made Max into more of a cliche than he ultimately is in this game. Yeah. Anyway, Ed, sorry, I spoke over you then.
There's a bit in the first game when Max is forced to imbibe drugs and starts hallucinating, and he has this sort of snap, trippy realization where he kind of looks into the camera and says, I'm in a video game, like that. And Steve, what you were just saying about how you get these characters and their excuses, like, oh, I was forced into it, something terrible happened in my past, etc. I do feel like that it's so right that Max Payne feels like he is, in some instances, trying to stay out of trouble, but it always arrives. And it's like Max Payne is getting on just fine, and then the video game like shows up, it like arrives to wherever he is. If he's in a bar, like the video game arrives and starts kicking off and he has to respond. And that is, you know, it's hinted at in that first game when he sort of acknowledges that he's in the game. It's in the second game, the funhouse thing that we mentioned earlier, which is this kind of like grotesque reflection of everything that's happened to him in his past, even though it's meant to be from an old television program. Mm. And it is like, yeah, Max is kind of painfully aware of almost, there's something like artificial about his existence that he can't escape out of. I'm always slightly turned off by like metatextual and like postmodern analysis of things, because I think that anyone who starts talking about, oh, this is how the films really work, or this is how fiction really works, is because they've run out of anything else to say. But Max Payne 3 makes a really good fist of it by having this guy who does all the typical video game guy stuff and then wonders how on earth he's gotten into it in the first place. That's why it's a funny game, I think.
Mm. And do we think in terms of, you kind of touched upon it there, Ed, I mean, in terms of like the way that games tell stories, obviously there was a thing recently by, you know, the internet kind of, the games Twitter went a bit mental recently over the...
Again?
You know, about games and stories and stories and games. I mean, do we enjoy this story of this kind of fucked up failure of a, you know, very, very big air quotes hero? You know, he's kind of does your standard shit, but not in the standard way. And, you know, there's not even a happy ending at the end of this, really. I don't look at the ending of Max Payne 3 and think, well, you know, he's made it, he's contented. I think he's fucking bored.
A couple of uplifting moments at the end, because he doesn't kill the final villain and just he injures him. And that's a kind of moment of restraint for Max, for this guy who's like been... And then he dies anyway, but
yeah,
still.
I was going to say, and there's a guy before him, isn't there, Becker, who... I mean, this is a problem with the story in so much as, you know... Your kind of end boss is someone who the game has given barely a shit about for the longest time until sort of the last hour. And then, oh, by the way, that's him. He's the bad guy. But I mean, there's an option, isn't there, at the end, whether you execute the guy or leave him to die. I'm curious what you guys did.
Oh, execute him. It's an action
big
film.
Time. Yeah.
I didn't.
He had to go.
When he was dead already. But
yeah. You know.
The thing about the story of Max Payne 3 is, yeah, we can sit here and talk about, oh, it's great that, yeah, like Max is a sort of sly recasting of the male hero in games. But the story is like overwritten and undercooked and confusing for no reason.
It seems to be going pretty straightforwardly up, you know, the whole kind of like with the protecting the family. I mean, we haven't really sketched out the story for people at home or people listening, but, you know, basically Max fucks up in New Jersey, kills a mob boss's son, gets whisked off to Brazil, where he takes up private kind of bodyguard work for a very rich family. And it turns out one member of that family is kind of double crossing all the others, trying to bump them off to get some money. And anyway, and so he's protecting them and they keep fucking getting kidnapped. And then Fabiana, the daughter, or the sister, daughter, wife of one of them dies. And then another brother dies horribly in a...
Marcello, is it? One of the most affecting death scenes. And it's one that, I mean, I don't think about it regularly because I try not to think about people getting tires piled up to their necks. And then, but in it's a game... It's a game of very gruesome elements, in, you know, like I said at the end of every shootout.
But they're not like laboriously focused on.
They've nicked it. They've nicked that death scene from a film called Elite Squad.
Which did that not come bundled with the game in some places? I'm sure I read that.
I think it was a Brazilian made or Brazilian finance film. I can't remember the name of it in Portuguese, so I apologise. But it was called Elite Squad over here, and yeah, they've nicked that scene. Word for word.
Well, I guess at least Rockstar have got the common courtesy to say, yeah, we stole that. And by the way, you guys should watch this film.
If Rockstar shipped its games with copies of every film that it was influenced by, you'd get like a carrier bag.
Yeah, it'd have to come with another, you know, DIY shelving unit with
a
every
box
game
set,
or something.
Yeah.
But with Max, another thing that you don't really realise, or, well, you know, you might think it, but it's confirmed towards the end, is that, yes, he is drunk, and yes, he has various problems in his life, and yes, he fails in a lot of the stuff that he does, but also he's being constantly undermined, not just by himself, but by other agents, and you don't really get that, or don't really the full extent of that until the end. I think it's until actually when you go to the Brancos office building, you have that big shootout and you realize that the only person who could have got in, killed the man you're protecting, knew the code to the helipad on the outside. So you know then, and then it's a bit like Victor is obviously the big bad and such. But with the younger brother, his line in the office about 20 minutes before that, when he says, why can't people, just because we've got loads of money, why can't they let us just live and have fun? And he's a lot younger than the other brothers.
Yes,
and then so he's actively probably the most innocent of them, Well definitely.
He's the biggest idiot, isn't he?
Yeah, and he is just, you know, he is a useful idiot to the people that want his family dead. And then so the thing that happens to him, his entire life is based around looks and, you know, partying and being the party boy. And he's always wearing all this, you know, very ghastly but expensive stuff, which, you know, it's all visual. So to see him get flambéed is something that when I see him in the game, when I'm replaying it, I'm always like, oh. Every time I see his jumper, I'm like, oh. Because just
it's man-made fibers, is it? It's gonna go bad for you, mate. But it's, I mean, in terms of sort of its presentation, you know, it definitely doesn't shy away from gruesomeness. But at the same time, I don't think it's overly gratuitous with it as well. Or not like, you know, it doesn't. Like someone tweeted in, we've got a bunch of tweets for later if we get time, and says about like how it's got one of the goriest kind of or the most violent endings of a game, but people don't talk about it very much. I guess it's because, you know, when Becker gets blown up by like a rocket of his own making,
and he loses an arm
and he's all burnt up on one side and stuff. But, you know,
is that any more violent than chainsawing things?
It's not. But it doesn't linger on it as much as it should. And like you say, like we said earlier on, like when you get this option to kill him, to put a bullet in his head, there's not even a prompt. Mm. It's just, you just see your little target over his head. And if you press the trigger, boom, he's dead. But like the game doesn't give you one of these kind of like Quantic Dream style, like either or situations, like let him kind of bleed out and die. I mean, in terms of the kind of, you know, it connects to the story, of course, the way the story is presented. I mean, Ed, Steve, I mean, is there any good thing about it? You've already said about the cuts. I mean, the cutscenes, it's not that they go on a lot, but they're a little bit too busy. Maybe there's a, you know, like the style of them is a little bit too, it over eggs itself a bit.
I think the story is nonsense and convoluted as opposed to complicated. And the scenes,
it's definitely
between,
too long. Yeah, it's definitely too long.
The scenes between Max and Passos are quite good. They've got a good dynamic, but the scenes between Max and the detective, I think his name is Wilson.
Well, he's barely introduced. This is another problem in the end of the game. You know, it's like they've had to staple another few hours of game on because the script didn't, you know, after Fabiana dies and once you realize who the Branco bad guy is, they go, oh shit, we better manipulate this in such a way so you get another 3 hours of shooting.
They do this. I feel like this might not be true, but it's certainly how the game sounds. Is you get the sense that they have some good, what they think are good lines of dialogue, some great like one-liners or just nice bits of cadence that they want to use, and then they write scenes around them. So you get these really strange like non-sequiturs in Max Payne 3 and dialogue that you can really kind of like hear falling down the stairs, like dunk, dunk, it's really like clunky. And you can really see the script, really like hear the script in a lot of the scenes in Max Payne 3. It's not a game that flows very, it's not like easy on the ears, as it were, dialogue wise. Yeah, I'm always like the Marcello death scene because it's nasty, but in a kind of way that like the death of a Bond villain is really nasty. It's kind of like it's like nasty where the sort of like you've got like a bit of a snarl, you're like, yeah, that's fucked up. I can't personally get too serious about like the intricacies of the plot because to me it's almost beside the point. I wish the game was better written. I wouldn't let them off for like having a bad plot. But the thrill of this game is sort of raw, and the thrill of that game isn't like it being just grotesque and bold and painting with broad strokes and just fucking more guns, more music, more sweat and more death. And that's what is good about Max Payne 3. And yeah, I feel like almost if I kind of intellectualize the story too much, it's doing the game a favor because the game is the story isn't that intellectual. The story is like really passe.
But I think its best moments, you're right, are in some of its dialogue when it's trying to get, you know, it's like, oh, this is the big idea for the scene, is not great. But some of the passing dialogue, I think when was it Passos turns up in New York and says, I've got the, you know, I've got the perfect job for you. And Max is just says something like, well, sitting around getting drunk and feeling sorry for myself. You're like, oh, you know, it's that. But then when it's like this grandstanding, and then towards the end of the game, when you realize that Victor's big thing is like selling people's organs. You know, the game doesn't need that. There's enough.
I played this last night and I'd already forgotten about that bit.
You know what? And you go into that and you go into that building.
It's about 5 minutes of the game's time. It's like, oh, by the way, there's this organ selling subplot.
Yeah. And there's that, you know, that kind of like cool in a very, you know, action movie way where he puts the bottle. The plastic bottle on the end of his gun.
The silencer. Because that works.
It doesn't work. But, you know, but I think Ed's right when you talk about the griminess of it. And I think what they do really well in it is that they change his, not just his look, but they change his outfit. And they change it in a way that actually, to me, makes clear how uncomfortable he is. So when he turns up in Brazil and he's wearing that suit, proper close protection look, like, you know, very flashy, I'm the bad guy's bad guy. And he just, it feels like it's making his skin crawl while he's in it. And then there's a bit later on, and this is a smaller bit where he's in Brazil, just before he goes to favelas, and he's wearing what I think is a new watch. And it looks like it's meant to be like a Rolex Daytona and it costs a lot of money. And it's just the sort of thing that someone who was a bodyguard to a rich man would buy. You'd buy because they get paid a lot of money and you buy the trinket because there's nothing else
to spend.
Well,
you don't know what to do with the money. Yeah, because you know, he lives in squalor, right?
Exactly. For him to have this watch says something about, to me, and it is very deliberate, like Rockstar, you know, for all their faults, there are reasons for this. And then the fact that that watch gets nicked later on, just to me, you know, that's a tiny little bit about the character. And they think they did the dressing of Max really well. Because if they'd started at the start, he's in Hoboken, he's dressed as Max Payne, it wouldn't have had as much effect as when you go, oh, he's back and now we can see how he looks. And then at the end, he's just wearing a vest and he's fat and he's bald and he's knackered and beard and whatever.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the way the way you control Max, he's really sluggish to move around. And you get they put some sort of weight on the movement and he does feel like you're sort of turning this quite slow, slightly drunk, old, heavy man around these levels. And it rhymes so well, like with what you just said, Steve, about his clothes. He does. He looks like he really is an ill fit in all of these environments. You know, literally, metaphorically, blah blah blah. And it's in everything. It is. It's in the outfit. It's in the fact there's no subtitles for the Portuguese. It's in the fact that he moves really really slowly. And then all the other things, like if you hit the painkiller, you know, the sort of basically the health kit, the medikit button, he has to like physically tip them into his mouth. You know, the reloads are sort of quite laborious and there's things scattered around, bullet casings and empty clips and all the sort of detritus of all these shootouts is left there. And
that's interesting, actually, yeah. When he does toss a clip away, it stays there, which I didn't notice until the second playthrough, yeah.
If you switch to a shotgun, he has to carry it in his other hand whilst he uses
I love that. But it's inconsistent in the cutscenes. Sometimes it's there and sometimes it disappears. Yeah.
But it reflects, I think, absolutely that kind of effort that Max is having to put in through the whole game. He can't just neatly tuck a shotgun into like invisibility,
Goes into carry his arm.
Yeah, he's like he's kind of just the whole game feels vaguely out of breath, and that's helped a lot. It's helped a lot by, you know, the kind of tribal drums on the soundtrack and him constantly like every single level is like an escape from somewhere or he's trying to chase someone. And there's just always this sense of being fucking like, exhausted. And that's what gives the shootouts a bit of like fucking bite and traction, because shootouts are so often breezy.
Yeah.
You know, one button to get in cover, one button to aim, and it feels very sort of methodical and oiled. And in Max Payne 3, everything just kind of feeds into this one moment where you're shooting a gun and it all feels very sort of heavy and slow and unpredictable. And that's why, I don't know, it's really pops like, the entire thing.
Well, let's talk shooting then, because it's a game about shooting in many respects. I mean, that is pretty much most of the things you're making Max Payne do when you're not, you know, in the quiet moments when you're doing that video game thing of scanning for various collectibles and, you know,
pressing E or whatever,
press to look Y at, to look at a tombstone,
yeah,
kind of bullshit. But I mean, I remember it. I'm pretty sure when it came out, it was this idea that like it was this revolutionary kind of style shooter, and obviously it brings bullet time from the previous Max Paynes. I mean, but I'm with you, Ed, in terms of like, I was surprised playing it again at just how kind of ungainly some of it is. Mm-hmm. Like the shooting is it gets very wild very quickly, and you know Max doesn't stand up to a lot of pain at all. You know, a few shots and he's down. You know, he is a dude after all. He never once straps on some body armor or anything. You know, it's not like you run over a vest and he magically gets stronger.
There is one moment of that.
Is there body armor?
Yeah, it's an optional thing you can collect in the police station.
I've not found that. Never.
But he makes a big effort to find it and put it on and zip it up. And yeah, it's still there. Like his vulnerability is still there when he's got the body armor on.
Right.
So if you take a headshot, you just essentially die.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You're still right. It's still true. He's weak. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I was surprised. I first playthrough, I remember the cutscenes. I remember bits of the story. By the time I'd finished the second one, you know, you look in the grinds, in the stats, and I'd killed over 2,500 people.
Yeah.
In about 15, 16 hours of playing a video game? That's a big body count, isn't it?
Yeah. I think with the shooting, there are moments in it, and I think it's the way that some of the stages are set up. They are so good in the level of destructibility. And when, you know, I'm not talking about Levolution, I'm talking about when you just start firing a MAC-10 and spraying it, and then suddenly like bits of paper are coming off of desks and, you know, CRT or LCD is just flying everywhere. And, you know, you're shooting through bits of cubicle and there's so, so punchy. And when you, to use an overused term, but it really is. And when you kill people, they stay hit, to use the football parts. They get hit and stay hit.
Yeah.
And their AI, it's not amazing in terms of they flank you quite well, but if you play it a lot, you see that when you start firing, they don't just duck into cover, they kind of flinch. So I shot a guy's gun earlier and he flinched. And even if you just like spraying over the top without looking down the sight, like they kind of like duck and they use their shoulders to roll their like head out of the way before they get out of there. And there's tons of tiny little things like that which make it feel so good. And I think on first glance, you can't, unless you play it quite a lot, you don't necessarily see all of that. But I do think that the character's heaviness is actually, I'd like the fact that he's kind of ungainly, but I do think that the game is too difficult even on medium. And I think that he moves in kind of like a box. You know, he doesn't turn.
Tanky.
Yeah, he kind of moves around a point in it. And there's just, I think there's too many deaths from that because of the way he moves. But still, I do love the shooting. And sometimes when you're running around an office with one handing, you know, a machine pistol and everyone goes down, you're like, man, this is the greatest game anyone's ever made.
office set is just wonderful.
The Branko's office, yeah.
Yeah, in the first shootout in that set, and he sort of tells the young receptionist and the computer expert, says, you know, get behind the desk, don't open the door. And he just kicks that door open and runs out, and the cutscene, you know, flows immediately into you playing it.
Yeah.
And they've all smashed in through the windows, got this huge, and it's, that's fucking how it's done. You know what I mean?
The way he runs in as well, I think you're right, Ed, that really struck me on my replay, is that, you know, when he says to the computer guy, he's like, right, stay here. And then he doesn't just poke his head round. He just, it's almost like, fuck
streams
this.
In.
And kicks the door open and just levers his way through it. And, you know, I think it's those kind of, you know, if to use the fucking Maxim action as character, like it's like he's finally had enough and now he's back to doing what he in those moments he kind of knows exactly what he's about.
A friend of mine had a bit of a theory on that, and he said that in Max Payne 3 you're playing as a character who's not actively but almost suicidal, so you're meant to play the gunfights in the same vein and just run in. And like just be brazen about it.
Yeah, but when I played it, anyway. Christ, you know, it doesn't last long if you try and play it that way.
I don't think that the cover shooter element helps it. And I think one of the things that I really like from Max Payne 2 is that the more you kill, the faster you get. And that I think that works better for 2. I'm not sure it would work amazingly well for 3.
It does have an adrenaline system, is it? They call it. Was that just multiplayer?
That's multiplayer, one. I believe. Yeah. But it's very obvious in Max Payne 2. Like, I think the screen gets yellower, and it's like that. The PS2 Shinobi game. Like, more kills you get, the faster you get, until everyone just drops around you, and the gunfight ends. But I think it sometimes Max Payne 3 really falls between two stools, and that why is you know. it's at its best when you're running in and, you know, kind of, and the animation looks so good when he's got a trailing arm and a pistol behind him and you're, you know, ducking into behind stuff. But then it's like the actually easiest way to play and the most effective way to play is to hit Q or whatever and go into cover and then just free aim. And I don't know, it's an uneasy alliance between getting a cover shooter element in there,
yeah,
but you've also got bullet time.
I mean, it gives you the dodge, shoot dodge, which, you know, it tallies how long you've spent in it,
yeah,
and everything. I mean,
that is great.
But I mean, it goes back to the weight of the character, I suppose. The shoot dodge in Max Payne 3, where he kind of launches himself
and smash your head into something.
He's fucking decks himself on stuff. It's quite, you know, it's accidental comedy in a lot of ways. I mean, I saw a video of it and I immediately did it when I got there in the kind of final stage, which is in an airport where you're chasing down Victor Branco before he gets on his plane and escapes. You can just slide down the middle of escalators, just shoot dodge your way onto the middle of the escalators. He slides right down, lands sprayed out on the floor, you know, just like a fat old drunk man, you know, which is exactly
like
what
us later on, Mike.
like us most evenings, I'm sure. Well, Ed doesn't drink. It's a good boy. But yeah, I mean, we've mentioned the office thing now. I just mentioned the airport. I mean, it's a game where, you know, it has a lot of flashbacks. It goes back to New York, to New Jersey. There's a whole, quite a long section in Panama, which is a flashback.
Yeah, I like that.
In the Panama Canal. I mean, do we have favorites between us? Times where you think, you know, that's where the game is at its best, for either because of the, you know, the moment-to-moment action or because of the environment it's in or the combination of both?
It's hard to choose. I think there are so many. And it's hard to choose, not because I don't think there's one level in Max Payne 3 that's definitive, but every single one has got like a sequence. And it's hard to pick which has got the strongest sequence or a couple of sequences. So I really like the first level in the favela, and you have the shootout in this sort of very unattractive looking strip club. And then which is a really, really, really horrible section. And then the rest of that level was great as well. But then you've also got the aforementioned level in Panama, which has got some of the best music in the game. And also this terrific sense of what the fuck is going on, because Max sort of wakes up from a drunken stupor to find that his people have arrived. And there's a sort of mystery in that level that you don't get in any of the others.
Well, that's what he's working out, who Passos is, effectively, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
Passos is his partner, ostensibly his partner at the start of the game. But yeah, it turns out that he's not all he's cracked up to be. But,
and then the police station, which I think is probably my favourite, for reasons, again, that I've struggled to articulate. There's something about this game that almost like belies words, and not in the sense that it's so good you can't put it into words. It's just like there's a sense in it that I can't quite yet reduce into words.
But the lovely police,
police station. Sorry.
That's okay. The police station, I think... you know what? I think about Max Payne is that it's doors. Now that sounds like a mental thing to just be like, it's doors. Like, but if, especially in the police station, now there've been a lot of police station shootouts in cinema and games. And, a lot of them just feel like offices where the police may be. But as you get deeper into that, a lot of the cutscenes are done on doors. There's reasons for that, like technically. But I love that any time that Max like enters the next, like he's wearied, and the police station just gets grimmer and grimmer from its top floor, which is respectable, essentially. And every time he opens a door, things seem to get worse and worse. And that is a far cry from one of...
Well, he ends up in the morgue, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then
no, wait, that's the cells. Cemetery, yeah.
He ends up in the cells and all of that. And when you consider the glitz and the glam of... I love the opening stages, you know, when he jumps onto like the awning and shoots the guy and lands up in the water feature.
He lands in the pool.
And then Passos says something like, do you need help? And Max is just like, no, do you? And then takes his gun, slicks his hair and just, but it's not like a cool thing. It's just in a very pissed off dad voice. Like, and then in the club, which follows that, the moment in the VIP area, and then there's a DJ
that's a kidnapping, isn't it?
Just before that's the kidnapping.
Yeah.
I mean, the bit that follows it where you're in the kind of like top of the building, I don't really like.
Yeah, but it ends up with a helicopter. There's a few rail shooter moments, aren't there?
But the police station is, I think, the favela is a moment where, you know, if you wanted to call it such, like the heart of darkness. Like he has to go into it, and you know he has to make, because he's making the journey there that he's been threatening for a while. But the police station just seems so otherworldly in its, what is, why am I here now? How has this happened? And then yeah, you find that body armor.
Turn yourself in, mate.
Yeah, exactly. But you find the body armor, and he's like, oh,
I don't.
Like he doesn't just go zip. He's like, as Ed's like, oh, do I have to put this on now? But yeah, I just think that the game, I think Ed's right, that the story is just, as soon as you get anywhere near that building, it's like hostel or saw or whatever, where they're harvesting the organs.
It's
like,
an old hotel, isn't it?
You're like, yeah, you're getting away from really what I really loved about the game. And there's just too many twists and turns. It just, I mean, as Ed says, the thing about him is he's just fucking knackered. Like, he doesn't need organ harvesting. That's
no,
not, you know.
This is making a bad day worse right now, isn't it? Or maybe, yeah, it's I mean, he says, I'm sure there's some quotes, I can't remember that he says something about, like, you know, this is a day that started lying in shit.
Yeah.
Know, in piss and shit. Because, like, he's in there. That's where he sees, what's his name? The Marcello is dead, and he hides with Passos's girlfriend, wife to be. Yeah. Who is the sister of Fabiana? It's not a very complicated relationship. I'm just trying to remember it.
Yeah.
You know, last night. But yeah, they kind of duck down. And weirdly, that's... So Max actually does get a rest. He has a little rest in the middle of this game.
Yeah.
Lie down for a few hours.
Yeah, he has a little sleep.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I think that one of the things about the police station level is there's a sort of severity in there, because you're not just fighting gangsters anymore. It's against the police.
Mm.
And it's like, we've really kind of, we've gone over the top here. Like the jug has tipped, because now Max is killing police officers, albeit corrupt ones.
Mm. Are they corrupt? You know, are they?
There's no way back from this. You know what I mean? It's when he kind of crossed the threshold.
I mean, he's doing again what he did in New Jersey, right? Where he has to leave. Like, he's now putting himself in a position. He can stay.
He can't stay here ever. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's basically shooting his way into exile with this level. And then another great level that I think doesn't get talked about as much when at least in conversation I have with about Max Payne 3, and I have them often, is the level at the dock when he's trying to rescue Fabiana, and there's the whole kind of boat shooting.
Like running across the jetties and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. And that level, I can't remember who it was, and I will have to look this up at some point, but there was either an author or a kind of literary critic, and she said that the strongest sense to evoke in writing is smell. Like, if you can make someone really smell an environment or smell a situation, then you really got right into their mind. And that level in the dock, like, fucking stinks. You know, Max has got his hair, like, kind of glued to his forehead, and he's covered in mud, and he's got, like, kind of that bloody arm he's still got from the stadium shootout. Yeah, yeah. And it really feels kind of fecal and like fetid. And
because he checks the water, doesn't he, before he gets into it? It's like there's tons of these tiny little touches where if it was, say, anyone from Gears of War, it would be, you know, they'd hit the beachhead, but they don't. Like, Passos pulls up and, you know, because he puts a silencer on just after that. And he goes to get out the boat, and then he looks in the water, and you're not sure whether the water itself is unclean or he thinks that there's something in there. But just with just a tiny little movement of his head, he's like, you know, is not all action, even though he is technically, but just the look of him, like,
there's a sense in that whole level that Max is contracting something, you know what I mean? Like malaria or cholera or something, just from being here. And it does, it makes the whole thing that little more like tangible, gives it that bit of bite that you don't get in games. Like, even the most violent games are so like airy sometimes. And Max Payne 3 goes to really extensive lengths to make you feel like you're there.
Yeah, there wasn't often where I kind of... Weirdly, the hotel, the organ hotel, I didn't vibe that as an environment. That did feel kind of thrown in there. It just felt like a generic kind of action horror game setting.
Yeah.
Like, broken
I think
that, down.
That's the weakest level, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I don't like about it, I generally don't like these in games anyway, but and I've forgotten about them until I replayed it, but Max Payne has QTEs. It has fucking, you know, quickly press this or quick, you know, quickly do this. Some of the time it's the slow motion, shoot grenades out the air. I mean, you know, the end boss, you know, again, very big air quotes, you know, you beat him by shooting one of his own rockets, you know, out of the air. And there are bits like there's a bus, there's the boat, and there's a helicopter, bits where you're just hanging off the side of a vehicle, kind of with infinite ammo, just like laying waste to people. And I just think, yeah, in those points, it's a little bit, it loses me a little bit. And also the QTEs, because they kind of come out of nowhere, some of them. It's like, oh shit. Like you're in this momentum of a game, lurching from this shootout to the next, to this fucked up situation, to, you know, crashing through a door, and then boom, all of a sudden you've got to press this thing real quick and you fuck it up. And it's like, you know, you get the kind of three stage dun, 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 dead.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh no, that you didn't need these here, Rockstar, really.
I like the bus one. I like the bus one because it turns into that great sort of, fuck me if you're using military terms like I know what I'm talking about. It turns into that great sort of static defense section where you're just in the back of the bus shooting out through the broken window or these
guys
like that.
But there's
a terrible quick time event during the Marcelo death sequence. And I forget the name of the character now. The scarred up face.
Yeah, he's one of the what are they called?
Commander
Kratos.
Yeah. And he's got a massive machete, right?
Yeah, and you've seen him a few times up until this point, and it's sort of barely implied that there's going to be some sort of, you know, encounter with him. And it's like you just tap three buttons and you kill him
It's literally left trigger, right trigger, A, I think.
Yeah, which is such a...
Press A to put his own knife in his own neck.
Yeah.
Such an anticlimax.
There's a few of them. I genuinely felt, and I said this on Twitter, and a few people said, no, the ending's great. You know, I thought by the time we got to the ending, you know, already, it was really over long. There are some great bits in that final level. You mentioned the music. That's when the people who did the music, Health, they kind of, you know, they kind of hit their crescendo, I suppose, with a track called Tears as you're plowing through this airport terminal. And, you know, there's even, you even get some vocals in there as well. It's like suddenly becomes almost like a murderous music video or something. But then the kind of QTE end, and it feels a bit anti-climax for me. And all of those kind of quick, now it's over QTE things do.
I think the end of the game for me is it is in the airport, and Becker is standing on top of this metal stairs with a grenade launcher. And there's a, I can't remember what the track is called. But it is another one by Health. Oh, it's going to annoy me now that I can't remember the name of it.
There's one after Tears, yeah, where
they're, and it's just drums. Exactly. And that to me is like, that's the swell of that game. That is the fucking moment in that game.
Well, that carries over, doesn't it, into there's a chase right at the end where
that's the bit it doesn't need.
You have to shoot. Oh my God, they're blocking the runway. Yeah. And, you know, there's nothing to it. You just point a gun and cars explode in front of you. There are bits of padding here.
Every level, I feel, is just about 10 to 15 minutes too long. Like every single one, even the levels that I really love, the Panama Canal bit is fantastic. And then that's one of the levels where you can really explore because you have all the cabins. And you know, when he goes
even
in there,
when you get out, you're in a visitor center, which is cool.
Which is kind of cool. You know? And then there's just another bit that goes on and on and on. And then suddenly they're zip lining in. And it's just the natural beat for it to kind of end is often missed by quite some distance. And especially, I mean, I kind of like the very end of it with the plane. Is he trying to take off and you get the
they're taxiing at least.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's not anywhere near as bad as the latest James Bond where he shoots the helicopter down with a pistol over by the Houses of Parliament.
Not talk to me about it.
Thankfully, I've not seen it.
But at the same time, but again, actually the bits that I didn't like in the airport were almost those middle sections where you're running through another atrium and all there is guys in armor. Even though the soundtrack is amazing there, I felt they could have just lost one of those.
Well, like you said, that's like a double. You basically repeat the same
thing.
Yeah.
So, and the same, you know, when you get to the top of the building, when you're at the very start of the game, and suddenly you have to get in a helicopter again, you're like, you know what, I just know. And the stadium, now, when they previewed the game, the stadium was the game that we saw. And that was where we saw all of the really cool mechanics for the first time, like the way the way the game operates generally in terms of how Max uses his body, how he uses his weapons, how he holds the weapons, all of that. But then by the end of it, you're in another sniper sequence, And there's a great moment in the bleachers where you just run out and leap. And you're like, you feel like you're 500 feet in the air, like oozing
the steps
people.
Away below you.
And the steps are obviously descending away from you. But then you're like, oh, now we're back into another atrium, another bit of the stadium. And to me, that's where it kind of really falls down because it has all this extra padding and then goes, yeah, but there's also a subplot about hearts and that. And you're like, I don't care about these people. I care about Max and his drinking
problem. I might have been more into the hearts and lungs and stuff if it had been better teased earlier rather than just walking into a, you know, you kind of go, okay, they're taking people away. What are they doing it for? Yeah, maybe that's one of 100 possibilities.
They're taking them away to code the levels for the rest of this game because we keep on putting more of them in.
It's a big team. I mean, the development costs, I mean, sorry to mention something quite prosaic this late into the podcast, but it cost, well, supposedly in the region of $105 million to make, which is more than Red Dead cost. But it sold, or it shipped, sorry, around about $4 million, which Take-Two had said was the amount they needed to sell to begin breaking even. So no more Max Payne then, guys. Pretty much is what what we're looking at.
I don't know about that, right? Because I like to think that Rockstar don't really care that much these days about money. I'm trying to think. I swear there's another game
they might
sold,
not, but Take Two certainly do.
I suppose Take Two.
But it had a lot of problems, didn't it? I mean, I remember when it wasn't it announced in 2009, and then immediately went dark. And
again, Red Dead Revolver sounded like sort of like shite, didn't it?
Yeah,
and I got to see.
Yeah, it did.
They didn't. I thought that Capcom was making it originally, weren't they? And then
they
took started over.
It,
and there seemed to be a lot of those issues with Rockstar. If you remember that GTA 4 was delayed by 6 months, and that was unheard of really at the time because you know you had those smaller development cycles. Vice City came out a year. Then you went to 2 years, and then you're up to, with San Diego for Red Dead Redemption. And then there was the issues with Max Payne as well. It seems like their kind of reach was almost exceeding their grasp and the things that they wanted to do. And it costs a lot of money to staff up. And like a lot of those projects would have just been, if not binned, put into turnaround or whatever. So in terms of its, you know, the costing, the gross cost as quoted, I think they're making so much cash and Max Payne is still a name that they could learn the lessons basically and go, right.
Is this the kind of game, we're obviously talking about it because we would encourage people to play it. Yeah. Is it the kind of game that would benefit at least from a Red Dead style backwards compatibility kind of Xbox One? Now you can play this on your new system. And you say it's still available for PC. Mm-hmm. I don't see it being a, you know, remaster candidate, but at least making it so that you don't need a 360 or a PS3 to play it on would be something.
Mm.
Yeah, if they put it onto the PlayStation 4 shop, like they have done with basically...
Bully, yeah.
Bully's on there, the Warriors is on there. I think, no, they've not gone as far back as Smuggler's Run, because nobody gave a fuck about Smuggler's Run.
Is table tennis on there?
Oh, come on now.
Not that I know of.
You know, why wasn't table tennis ever a minigame in another Rockstar game?
It kind of is, isn't it? Like,
well, can't you, in GTA 5, you can play tennis.
You can, can't you? Yeah. Mm. No minigames, no Rockstar-style minigames in Max Payne 3, but you can watch the TV, I noticed. And like I said, there's moments where he can play the piano, but those TV things are weird. Do you think those are hangovers from... Do you think the TV... Well, so there's like a whole TV show in there.
Well, I think the other ones, Baseball Bad Boy in the other games, as I was saying earlier, you know, when he says, I'm in a video game, it's the whole game is about you being in a video game and you knowing that you're in the video game. And Captain Baseball Bat Boy often refers to things that you've done or foreshadows things that you will be doing. At one point you get tied to a chair and you fight your way out with Captain Baseball Boy's baseball bat, essentially. Or you see something like that and then it happens. I think that's the bit of the difference between the games. But yeah, I actually think it's a game that it gets stronger. Because I reviewed it years and years ago, and yet it's still floating around in my brain. And I think because exactly of those reasons that we've talked about, that and Alien Isolation, occasionally I just think, Man, I really liked Alien Isolation.
Isolation is very well,
that was well
gen,
long,
though,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh yeah, too, another game that suffered from padding. Yeah, but weirdly, one that didn't was which obviously has had a bit of a, or enjoying a bit of renaissance right now because it's coming out on PC, is Vanquish. That kind of floats around the same area as Max Payne 3 for me as a previous gen game that I think about a lot and would like to replay, and, and I probably will replay now my 360 setup. But just between us guys, I mean, I want to read out just a few tweets, but like any kind of closing thoughts on Max Payne 3 that we haven't maybe touched upon yet? You know, Ed, I know you probably got lots of ideas that you have, lots of thoughts that you haven't been able to say yet.
I think the closing recommendation I'd give for Max Payne 3, and it is a recommendation even though it's a game that's not without its shortfalls, but Max Payne 3, if you talk about, I don't know, this is a particularly flowery comparison, so forgive me, but if you talk about how certain film directors have perfected certain techniques, like John Huston and the Western and whatever, and P.T. Anderson and the Long Shot, Max Payne 3 is the shootout. Like no game has done shootouts, just purely like focused so much on shootouts and got them so right, and it's worth playing just for that.
I agree, I think
further to that, it's just what we were talking about, just that the game actually gets better in terms of Max himself, not the story, but the character, or more interesting the more you play it and the more you pick up, because a lot of the delivery of his dialogue is very curt or, you know, snidely, you know, phrased, or, but it's when you go back, there are lines that I just did not remember being in there, and yeah, it's just very interesting. After another 5 years of man with gun handles scenario, Max's gun handles this scenario up until the point where everyone dies and then makes everything much worse.
Yeah. The more he kills, the worse it gets for the most part. Quite a few people seem to be quite engaged with this game when I asked for any comments or questions. I mean, I'll just read out a few. We obviously mentioned, that violent death scene, by the way, comes from an At Lithium project, so thanks to them, regarding Becker's demise. At John Jin, he says he was never been a fan of horde modes, but if ever there was a game crying out for it, it's Max Payne 3, the best shooter, but with too many cutscenes, which kind of goes bang.
There is an arcade mode, though.
There is an arcade mode, isn't there? Which
has no cutscenes.
Yeah.
It's a good way to actually experience the game once you've finished it.
I know,
in terms of like a properly made or, you know, for that horde experience, but I, you know, arcade mode's fairly cool.
Yeah, quite a few people said about the, well, Jamie Otzer, my main question was why it's nowhere near as good as the first two, and says that Max Payne 3 broke his heart.
Expectation is a terrible thing, my friend.
Yeah, I guess so. Max Payne 3, this is from Bellarius. Max Payne 3 on Twitter, wasn't a good Max Payne game, but it was an excellent Stranglehold follow-up.
No.
Ooh.
No, come
hey,
on.
Listen.
Come on,
I never played John Woo's
Stranglehold. Was a long time ago, and I kind of liked it.
Stranglehold is a shambolic. I don't mind the game, but...
We should point out, that's a very early Xbox 360 game, isn't it? Yeah.
Stranglehold is... It's meant to be like a John Woo thing. And John Woo's movies are like balletic and choreographed and whatever. And Stranglehold, you're just bumbling. Like it's very scrappy and very whatever. Max Payne 3, as we talked about, I think for a lot of the show, is cohesive. The fights are quite lumbering at times, but it feels sort of, there's a poetry between it and everything else that's going on in the game. Stranglehold's just a mess.
I've seen it plenty of times for like 50 pence and I've never picked it up, which probably
still
tells
right.
us something.
I bought it new. But then, you know, I had, you know, what else was there to play?
Well,
exactly. When you first got the PS3, it was Stranglehold, The Darkness, and Modern Warfare.
Hey, The Darkness is all right.
Yeah, I love it.
Sequel's much better.
Controversial.
Sequel's much better.
This is a whole other podcast.
We'll get on to this later.
It's the 10th anniversary of The Darkness in a few weeks.
Well,
Should we
listen,
do this again?
We'll do it.
It's got Mike Patton in it. I'm writing about that right now, Mike Patton, for the magazine. Anyway, Richard Wakeling, who's written for us before, he says he loves how Max's appearance changes. It reflects his mental state, leading to the obvious symbolism of shaving his head. We did kind of mention he shaves his head, but I mean, this is after Fabiana dies, and it's after he fails to catch her at the dock.
It's after the explosion at the office.
It's after the office explosion.
Fella. Yeah.
I mean, is that on the nose then, or was it? It was all right. I mean, did he have nits from his apartment, which was minging?
It's something you get in. There used to be a net, but there still is a name for it. I mean, I used to remember the name for it. In noir movies, there's usually a scene where the character like shaves or removes their hair or sort of dresses themselves properly several the whole time because they're preparing for the sort of confrontation. It's like a kind of purging moment. And I think that it's one of those.
That's what that represents. It's amazing that we've got this far into this podcast. That's the first time anyone said noir for a game series that was entirely rooted in that.
Yeah. Was.
I don't think Max Payne is at all. There's bits of it, the cemetery bit, maybe.
They call it neo-noir.
Yeah, which just makes me think of The Matrix, what with all the jumping around bullet dodging, doesn't it? But thanks to everyone that... Oh, should I mention him? Why not? Kurt McKean. We know him, don't we?
Oh, we do. We know Kurt.
He just said, good game, but too many cutscenes. I think that's... And Max Payne 3's unfortunate legacy in a way. There's too many, but...
They just cover up the loading, don't they?
They do, and there's a lot of that.
Yeah. Yes, even now, sorry to mention, it's just the what I'm playing it on, but you think 5 years later on, you know, the PC, you can skip some of the cutscenes, but then if you hit a button, it just says, still loading.
Still loading.
As if you're being told off, like, don't, not now, not now, mate.
Don't rush us.
It'd be like, it's 5 years, okay?
You still need a super PC to run it, probably, yeah. Well, cool. I mean, thanks, guys. And thank you for listening to us talk about Max Payne 3 for a whole bunch of time. I was going to ask you guys what you've been playing more recently, but frankly, I can't be asked.
I don't play video games.
No, you don't. And Ed, I think what have you been doing for bullet points, Ed? For your bullet points?
We're doing Prey this month, and I need to get cracking with it. I finished a game earlier this week or last week. Oh, God. I'll tell you what I've been playing. I know what I've been playing. I went and got, because I'm planning to do something on it, and because I'm doing my annual rewatch of all the Bond films and reread of all the Bond novels because I'm a freak.
You're a bit of a, you've got a Bond book in you at some point, Edwin.
That'd be great. So I went and bought 007 Bloodstone from 2011.
The best 5 out of 10 game of all time.
That is a game that I think like 8 people bought. And I finished that the other day. So
it's a game by a driving developer by Bizarre Creations, where the driving is terrible.
After Blur.
Where the driving is terrible, and the shooting is just
that game
just,
killed Bizarre.
When I was playing the driving, I was like, "How on earth have these guys done?"
But presumably, it's because the driving guys were making Blur. And the other guys in the office were making...
But you think they'd go, guys, that we're having a bit of trouble with the old...
Do you know
the old
anything
thing
about
we're famous
car
for?
Physics? Maybe. Nice. I've never played it, but oh dear, well that's not so good. I was playing Thumper this morning on the Switch.
Ooh.
I'm glad that's coming to the Switch.
Yeah.
Thumper's a game. In fact, if you like the health soundtrack to Max Payne 3, you'll probably like the music in Thumper as well. It's pretty pounding. Where on earth... in the wild west of the internet, can people find you chaps if they want to follow you and listen to your inane tweets? Listen to them? Read them.
What a terrible thing to say.
Well, they're not always
the inanity of the last line, was it?
Well, you just talk about golden Uzis.
Golden Uzis. Which is the Steve Burnham. I have the golden Uzis. I realised today when I booted it up that I have the golden. It's actually Mac 10. But listen, Jim Burns Dave is, that's me and my boys, our production company.
Yeah.
And we do like videos and
I didn't even mention that you make films, Steve. Sorry.
Yeah, we made the best Resident Evil movies of all time.
There you go.
That's a fact.
You can find them on the internet. Ed, I mean, obviously you write for Waypoint on the regular pretty much, but you do Bullet Points as well. What else is going on for you? I mean, Bullet Points, everyone should check out. It's a great podcast and website.
I should add that the university course that I went on and the university that I went to was the same one attended by Paul W.S. Anderson, who did the Resident Evil films.
Paul Wankstein Anderson.
Yeah, he was a beloved son of the Warwick University Film Studies department.
Because he did Shopping. I bet that's the fucking reason, isn't it? And also, I saw American Splendor in Warwick at the university, and it broke. The projector broke, and it took me about 5 minutes to realize that the projector had actually broken, and it wasn't just the film being the film, you know. So there you go.
Well, good. Ed, where can people? And you're on Twitter as well, obviously. But if people want to follow you, because you mainly tweet about your video game stuff, to be fair.
Yeah, sorry, the audio blanked out there for a second, so I don't know if you said anything that I've missed. But yeah, you can, bulletpointsmonthly.com is the website where we write about shooters, me and some other people. And yeah, I'm on Twitter. Just put Ed Smith Waypoint and you can find me on Twitter.
And do that. Yeah. While you're on Twitter, you can follow Waypoint at Waypoint. You can find us on Facebook. Please do at Waypoint Vice. You can follow our streams on Twitch at /Waypoint. You can visit the Waypoint website, which is waypoint.vice.com, which is where we put all the wonderful stuff, including the podcasts, the videos, and tens and hundreds of articles written by fantastic people about fantastic things. Thanks for, I always say tuning in. No one tunes into a podcast, do they?
What granddad speak
that's
is old, this?
Old patter, that is. The next Waypoint podcast, though, is live on June the 1st when, Steve, you're coming back. I've got here in my notes that you're coming back.
These are the facts.
These are allegedly the facts.
For E3.
Yeah, we're going to try and talk a little bit about what may or may not be happening at E3 because you're going.
Yeah.
I'm not going. Yeah. We've both been. We've been there. Thanks again to my guests, Steve Burns and Ed Smith. Thank you for listening to us waffle on about Max Payne 3. Do check it out. It's one of the last generation's more interesting man with guns destroys lots of other men with gun games. Have a lovely rest of your day. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.